Welcome to Consciously Speaking, exploring the evolution and revolution. On Consciously Speaking, you'll be introduced to guests from all walks of mindful development. Spark up your spirituality, crank up your consciousness, and mend your mind right here on Consciously Speaking with your host, Michael Neely.
Hello, conscious explorers. Welcome to your favorite spot for mindful awareness and waking up. I'm your host, Michael Neely, and you're listening to Consciously Speaking. You know, in order to keep bringing you these shows, which I hope you love as much as I love putting them on for you, we'll eventually need sponsors. And in order to get those sponsors, we need to know more about you. Not a lot, just 7 simple questions on our super short audience demographic survey. I hope you'll take a moment after you listen to today's show to fill it out. You can find the link to the survey on the show notes or at www.michaelneely.com. Thank you in advance for doing that. And now, I'd like to introduce you to today's guest, Michael Mojeleski. Michael is a correspondent co-host for Earthwise, the anchor TV show on the Outdoor Life channel, featuring all the powers and nuances of the natural world. He's a roving correspondent for the national radio show The Good Life, reporting from the field on his adventures all over the world. But before all this, Michael grew up in Cleveland, Ohio, where his father played professional football with the Browns. He graduated from Indiana University with a BA in journalism, and for the past 12 years has traveled to 40 countries around the world on assignment for national publications. He's the author of several books, including Angelus Crest, a memoir, Inside Passage, Living with Killer Whales, Bald Eagles, and the Kwakiutl Indians, and North Through Paradise. His speech, Triumph of the Spirit, is an inspiring, motivational account of what it takes to survive, then thrive in the wilderness, or any challenging situation, really. After living dateless on the wild island, upon returning to civilization, Michael was startled to find that he was chosen Cosmopolitan Magazine's Bachelor of the Month and Alaska Men Magazine's Centerfold Story. After receiving 5,000 letters from women around the world, he married one of the correspondents. Michael's latest book, Wildlife, The Misadventures of a Cosmo Bachelor, is attracting rave reviews from everyone except his mother. You know, once referred to as the John Muir of our times, I'm excited to bring him to you today on Consciously Speaking, and you can find out more about Michael at www.michaelmojeleski, which you're going to have to read on the show notes.com. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Oh, Michael, thank you so much. It's an honor to be here.
You know, what you do sounds super exciting. But as you know, we're all so much more than what we do. So I'd love for you to share with me and our listeners about Michael Mojeleski, the man, and your purpose here on Superman's second home planet.
Well, I really feel that it's not, just as you mentioned, it's not so much what we do, but it's who we are. And whenever I travel in the world, especially in third world countries, or I'm interacting and interviewing, quote, primitive people who are often the most advanced in their thinking, living in harmony with the earth for so right. many centuries. They really don't care what you do. In fact, the Kwakiutls and the Tlingits up in Alaska, where I spend most of my time, they have a great saying that the poorest man is the one who only has money. So they are all about growing a soul and giving, living to give. Which, as you know, I'm sure the little bit we do give out, if it's done, you know, with purity, we get back 100-fold. So, and another expression that I kind of live by is we attract what we are inside. And I really believe that we manifest reality just like a movie director would by the levels of growth that we are at internally. So as much as I try to live and push the limits in the external world, I also try to develop that soul and that internal growth. And I find that the deeper I go inward, the higher I go outward.
Nice, nice. So, Michael, what lights you up in the morning right now and makes you want to jump out of bed and tackle the world?
Well, you know, one of my gigs is in the summertime. I'm on a cruise ship in Alaska. And everything, my whole career really started living in the wilderness and the great mention, thank you very much for the book, Inside Passage. I spent 2 years living in isolation on a wilderness island in a beautiful area called the Inside Passage from Puget Sound, 1,000 miles north of Glacier Bay, Alaska. And while I was out there, that's really where I wrote my first book and where everything came together. So now in the summertime, I share that knowledge of kayaking with the killer whales, learning from the native people on a Princess cruise ship. And the funny thing is how life can go full circle. We go by the very wild island that I lived on all alone. Only now I'm with 3,000 people in the band playing.
Wow.
And after I do my PowerPoint presentations in the big house, the theater, I have a book table outside the theater and I sell my books and people come by. And I mean, I just fill journals up with nuggets of life experience and gold that people share with me. We get 30 countries every week to come on the cruise ship from around the world to see the beauty of Alaska in all 50 states. So one day, a very famous psychiatrist from New York City came up to the book table and she said, "Michael, if you buy me a glass of wine later, I will explain you to yourself."
Oh.
I mean, who's going to say no to that?
Right.
And instead of spending her, her normal fee of God in New York, it'd probably be $500 to $800 an hour. It cost me like $5 for, you know, a glass of wine.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, "I must tell you, I have never seen such naked passion before in my life." She said, "When you walked out on that stage, if you would have had your clothes off, you couldn't have been more naked than you just were with your clothes on." She said, "You just opened up your rib cage and you showed us your heart and you just let Alaska and beauty and magic flow through you." So she asked me, you know, that question that we all kind of get sooner or later is, "What's your first memory in life?" And I told her, I don't know what age I was. Maybe I was 2 years old in a suburban backyard in Cleveland, Ohio. I mean, at that age, you can run around naked and it's not sexualized, or at least it better not be. You know, you're in an age of a sort of a bubble of innocence,
mm-hmm.
being two, and you know, you can run around in the sprinklers and all that in the hot summer weather and it's no big deal. So my first memory of life is being naked, running around hugging everybody. And she said, "My God, man, you're one of the few souls I have ever met who is doing as an adult exactly what gave him the most joy as a little boy." She said, "You're still doing the same thing, only now you're giving us this gift of nature and Alaska that's ripping through you, you know?" So I came away from that 1 hour spent with this, you know, master of the mind, this psychiatrist, and she explained me to myself, and I find my calling is to give love and create beauty.
Nice. You know, I want to backtrack a little bit because I know as part of your journey, you originally in college started to follow your father's footsteps, you know, playing sports and football and before shifting gears and deciding to become a writer. And I'm curious, where did the wilderness wanderer develop in you and what made you take that journey on of all the journeys you could have chosen?
Well, you know, as my mother and I often joke and I say that I really don't have a mother. I have a smother. And I think all mothers are smothers because, you know, it's a cold, cruel world out there. But when you have an Italian mother, I think Italian mothers and Jewish mothers are the worst motherers. And her whole attitude was when, you know, the kids were growing up is, "Oh my God, don't live. You might die. You know, I worry from the womb to the tomb." So she was all about woe and my dad was about go. Like my dad, the pro football player, he'd come home from football practice and he'd say, "The only four-letter word I don't want to hear in this house is can't. You kids can do anything in life if you just work hard enough and put your mind to it."
Nice.
But great thing about my mother is she was a reader. And every night when I was a little boy, I don't know, later, you know, not two, but little 6, 8 years old, she would read me to sleep every single night. With all these great stories of adventure, King Arthur, Knights of the Round Table, the Tales of the Arabian Nights, Grimm's Fairy Tales. And one night she picked up The Call of the Wild by Jack London. And I don't know why that book in urbanized Cleveland, Ohio, at the age of 6, 7 years old, why it resonated so deeply. But it almost gave me the blueprint for the future, the subjects of my work and writing. And the strange thing was, is she said, Michael, I kept reading after your eyes were closed and your chest was moving up and down. In other words, you were asleep. And I think it's been proven if people want to learn a foreign language, you let the tape recorder run all night. Mm-hmm. And I really believe that the subconscious never really sleeps. I think there's a light flickering on within us, kind of an awareness at all times. So I think I sponged up, you know, all those great stories of adventure. And there was that Jack London book, Call of the Wild, literally, that that kind of set my path for the future.
Mm. What a great path it seems like, too, because you spent, I mean, a couple of years out there in the wilderness on your own, you know, totally solo. What did it feel like then to go from that, as you call it, the land of no dates, to being inundated with offers when you got back?
It was absolutely la vida loca. I mean, it was the craziest shift to go from famine to feast. Mm-hmm. In fact, the Alaska government sent surveyors, it was been about 15 years ago, I guess. They were very curious as to the ratio of the citizens living in the wilderness, which is most of that place of the state of Alaska. I mean, the towns are so small and so few. So most people live out in the bush close to nature. And they were really curious as to the ratio between, you know, male and female, what the percentages were. So they sent surveyors out to count heads and they came back shocked because in Alaska and northern British Columbia, for every 10 men, there's only one female. In fact, the gals up there have a saying that the odds are good, but the goods are odd. And I was one of those odd goods, you know. Uh-huh. These guys, I think men tend to be more of a lone wolf. I think women are more communal and, you know, we're kind of talking to ourselves and twitching around if another human being comes by. And mm-hmm. So here I am for a 2-year period. Not having, you know, any females around, no dates. And when the full moon was out and the wolves were howling, I'd be out there, sheer loneliness. Mm-hmm. So I read my first book and not knowing any better on what the process is of getting an agent and, you know, how hard it is to get it over the castle wall to a publisher. Just as a fluke, I mailed it directly to HarperCollins, one of the biggest publishers in the world in New York City. And there's a slush pile of unsolicited work that's probably as tall as Mount Everest. And one of the editors was going back to his desk to eat a sandwich for lunch. And he saw this long Polish last name sticking out of the bottom of the pile of mm-hmm. manuscripts. And he happened to be Polish himself. So he tugged out the story, sat there and read it. And, it never happens that, you know, an unrepresented writer would get accepted, especially by HarperCollins. Yeah. But, you know, it went through. Then I came back to do publicity and, Helen Gurley Brown, who died, I guess it's been about a year and a half now, 2 years. She took a little magazine called Cosmopolitan when it was about to go bankrupt. And she put it into, it's the best selling women's magazine in the world now, goes into 100 countries, translated into 87 languages. And every month they put a single guy in there, Bachelor of the Month, for the Cosmo girls who are anywhere from 25 to 50 to write to. So they hatched this plan, HarperCollins and Helen Gurley Brown, and for reasons why I'll never figure out. Why HGB, Helen Gurley Brown, chose moi to be Mr. November. But I come back off the island. I can barely talk. I can't walk because in the wilderness, when you walk on those trails in those rainforests up there, detritus, pine needles have drifted down to the forest floor over thousands of years. You are literally walking on a trampoline inside that rainforest. You have a bounce in your step. I got off the airplane in New York City. I couldn't walk. My muscles didn't work on concrete anymore. So I'm walking side to side instead of north to south, and people are knocking me over the pace of New York. in the wilderness, it's very Zen. You do one thing at a time. You play the center of the note, as musicians say.
Mm-hmm.
You're very in that slow, deliberate moment. And now everything, there were 22 layers coming at me all at once. And I'll never forget, I went into the men's room, not to go to the bathroom, but just to sort of calm my breathing down. I guess I was having, you know, some sort of a nervous breakdown. And the damn toilet kept roaring at me. You know, it was one of the automatic toilets. And I mean, I came from that world. I certainly knew what a toilet was, but I felt like a stranger in a strange land.
Mm.
The 2 years in that wilderness wiped the slate clean. It gave me that fresh perspective coming back to civilization. So I go and I find out there's 5 gray canvas mailbags full of perfume letters and lingerie, and it was every man's fantasy.
Wow.
You know, and because Cosmo goes into 100 countries, I mean, there was mail for Mongolia, South Africa. It was like the master of the universe said, kid, this is a female candy shop. The door is open to you. Walk in. The lids are off all the jars. Help yourself to as many flavors for as long as you want. I mean,
wow.
All my male friends were going nuts. They said, dude, this is like, you know, unbelievable. You don't even have to work for it. It's all dropped in your lap here. And one of my good friends, Michael Larson, a very good literary agent, he said, Mike, Sigmund Freud once asked what the women really want. You have got a shot at finding out. Why don't you take notes during every date? And why don't you study these women like you studied the wildlife in Alaska? So that's why the book has sort of a double meaning in the title. The first two words are wildlife, two separate words, meaning the life is wild, but also studying the women as if they are wildlife.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, but this is my life. My life is always extreme. It's one thing to the direct opposite other, you know, and what I learned during those years of dating the Cosmo girls and then having a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow and finding a life partner, it was just invaluable.
Mm.
Because this one woman told me, she said, men know how to tune up a car, but they don't know the first thing about turning on a woman. You want to learn? Oh, yes, please.
Yeah. So Michael, what did you learn in the wilderness? This is the part I'm curious about. What did you learn in the wilderness that translated well into your new romantic adventures? You know, what did you bring back from there?
You sure made a deep connection there. It's so true. I have a native teacher in Alaska. Her name is Lucy, which means lucid, which means light. And this woman was a shaman. And, I mean, we got so close. It was almost on a telepathic level. We didn't even have to speak verbally. And she said to me, where you are going back to civilization in New York City is far more dangerous than the wilderness because your emotions will be involved. You know, a grizzly bear is pretty easy to figure out.
Mm-hmm.
Once you learn its body language and, you know, how to drop a shoulder when you're around him to show subservience, you never look him in the eyes. You give him that 3/4 view because if you look him in the eyes, that's a challenge. Let's fight. I mean, once you learn all of that, you're pretty safe. But with females, the human female animal, oh, my God. I mean, in that whole business of, you know, studying them like you study the wildlife, use the scientific method, all that, that went out the window on the first date. And I mean, you know, women are so complex, but that's what makes it interesting. If we could figure them out like we can grizzly bears, then there'd be no challenge.
That's true.
I think the thing that prepared me was to get over my fear. Because so many times being isolated in the wilderness, like if we have 9 lives like a cat, I probably have 1.5 left. I mean, I came so close to death, but I really believe we all have a blueprint for our life and there's an exit plan. There's an X marks the spot somewhere in our lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what stupidity, at least that I do, you don't check out yet until you reach that marker of when you're meant to go.
Mm-hmm.
And getting over all those physical challenges, overcoming my fears, you know, and I guess I did have sort of a deep deep-seated fear of women, you know, and getting hurt or causing hurt. But yet when I came back out of the wilderness, I felt a lot more confident about myself. And then, of course, internally reflects externally, I felt a lot more confident, you know, about the women that I dated as well.
You know, you've been on Oprah a couple of times, and one of those times was as a romance coach. So I'm wondering, what advice would you give to guys out there that you think are key factors in attracting the right woman? And maybe even more importantly, recognizing the right woman once you have attracted her.
Well, you know, the funny thing is a lot of guys come up and they go, Mike, you know, they're sort of the players and they're going, what's the best pickup line? And I go, you know, the best pickup line is one word.
Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
If you're not playing any games, if you are genuinely in the moment, if you're consciously speaking from authenticity, then that's what magnetizes your energy. That's what makes you charismatic. That's what attracts women.
Mm-hmm.
It's these game players. It's these guys that are trying to run a line and to be something that they're not. And I'll never forget, I was on an airplane coming back from London, England, doing some interviews for BBC radio when my first book came out and the whole Cosmo thing hit. And there was this guy in the middle of the night, you know, you kind of sleep on and off, read, nap. And I was awake, middle of the flight, dark. You got that engine hum at 30,000 feet. And this older gentleman's coming down the aisle and he recognized me because I had been on some TV shows then and my first Oprah and all that. And an older guy, and he admitted that he was not the most handsome man in the world, but he told me something I never forgot and I put into my book, Wildlife. He said, Michael, I'm what you might even be considered ugly. But he said, you give me 10 minutes talking to a woman and I can erase my face. And I'm going, whoa. And, you know, it's kind of the story of Cyrano de Bergerac, for the guy that had the big bulbous nose, and he's feeding the poetry to the young suitor who's then, you know, passing those lines on to the woman. You know, who eventually realizes it's not coming from this lightweight guy, but who's writing this poetry? And Jerry Femina, I'll never forget, I can erase my face. And I think men are very visual. We're attracted, you know, through our eyes. And with women, it's very different. They will go out with a man who is not a 10 or, you know, top of the line attractive if he has those internal qualities. You know, if he is a man of spirit and mind and has that genuine authenticity.
I agree with you there, 100%.
For more Consciously Speaking, go to michaelneely.com. Sign up for the Art of Forgetting newsletter. Keep up to date on the latest blogs, podcasts, and more.
You know, and Michael, I know that you ultimately, through all of this dating, you, from that group even, I believe, you found your wife. And so I'm wondering as well, now you're still currently traveling so much with what you do. How does that work out in your relationship now?
Well, the strangest thing is, and I started out as a travel writer for magazines and newspapers, LA Times, New York Times, and I didn't know this at all. Paula, when I met her, and to this day, is a flight attendant. She started with Continental Airlines and they then merged with United. And when we were dating after about a month, she threw a t-shirt at me and it had a slogan across the front, marry me, fly free. And I go, what? And she goes, yeah. And she just said it like a tossed off line. You know, if we would ever happen to get married, you have free airline tickets for life. And I go, what? And she goes, yeah, all my immediate family gets put into the computer. And you know, Michael, when you take away the airfare, that's the most expensive and oftentimes prohibitive part of traveling the world. But if you can get rid of that airfare, the $2,500 to go to Africa or China or whatever, I mean, hotels and car rentals are not that much.
Right.
So I go, is this for real? And she goes, yeah. So we had a trial period. She had what are called buddy passes. So I was living in San Francisco at the time, doing some press stuff out there, and she would call me up and say, hey, get busy, go take a shower. There's a buddy pass waiting for you at SFO. Meet me in Aruba tomorrow at noon for lunch. And I go, Aruba? That's way down across the U.S., down in the Caribbean. She said, shut up, get busy, and go pick up your free ticket.
I like this
So
one.
I'm sitting at Sam Shrimp Shack like at 11:59, you know, the next morning. And here comes Bo Derek in slow motion with the braids, you know, jogging down the beach toward me. And I'm going, man, I could get used to this.
Right.
So we courted each other, dated in Paris. And so when we finally got married, it's the free tickets. And in fact, we just went to China to study the panda bears a couple of weeks ago. And we were on the 787 Dreamliner, the brand new airplane. We sat up in global first class because, you know, you watch the loads. If there's empty seats, they put the employees or husbands up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're eating caviar and drinking champagne, and I'm going, oh my God, I guess I chose the right wife.
You sure did.
So we both are in the travel business. You know, Paula as an immediate direct worker, and myself as sort of a storyteller interpreter. Mm-hmm. You know, so it's kind of a match made in heaven that way.
Yeah, great combination. So, Michael, we're at a part of the show where I just introduced a new question, and it's time for a reveal. So I want you to complete this sentence for me. If you really knew me, you'd know that blank.
I'm very shy.
Really?
Yeah, there's a saying that courage is a form of fear turned around. And I think the shyness is a strength. In that I can sit alone in a room for 10 hours a day and write a book and not really need to be around white noise and other people. And yet I'm very much a public person in that I go on stage the other half of the year, you know, open up the rib cage, share the soul, let Alaska come ripping through in nature as a public speaker and doing TV shows and things like that. But that's difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very easy for me to be alone as I was on that island to write, to create. And, you know, so most people go, oh, you couldn't be that. I never would even think of you as being, you know, a shy person. But I have to force myself to take that step, you mm-hmm. know, to get out there because I learned so much from human beings. I mean, every person is 100 books from mm-hmm. what they've learned throughout life. And I want to know everything and go everywhere, you know?
Yeah. No, I get it. You know, I grew up, my first profession was as an actor, and I experienced a similar thing. You know, I was very shy, and people just couldn't believe that I was an actor being shy. And for me, it was just, there's something different about it. It was about, you know, conquering that fear, tackling it, and getting out there. But so I get where you're coming from.
You know, Michael, my dad gave me this DVD of his favorite cartoon. And I vaguely remember seeing it on TV, you know, when I was really, really young, but it was called The Roadrunner. And remember Meep, where
oh, yeah.
Wile E. Coyote, his life's mission was to catch the Roadrunner.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he never could. You know, and I just read the other day and somebody ruined it for me. They said, well, do you know that a coyote can run at 40 miles an hour and a roadrunner bird can only run at like 12? So it didn't, oh, come on, don't ruin the cartoon, you know?
Yeah.
So there's one scene that I tell people what it feels like maybe to be an actor, to walk out on that stage or have a camera on you or a public speaker when you part that curtain and step out there in front of that full house. Wile E. Coyote is chasing Roadrunner. Roadrunner goes over a cliff, and instead of falling to his death, he grabs a branch that's sticking out of the side of the cliff and holds on and saves himself. But Wile E. Coyote, with his monomaniac intention of catching the Roadrunner, you know, with the blinders on, that's all he lived for, is actually off the cliff. And he is running across the sky in the air. His intention is carrying him that far. And then all of a sudden he gets self-conscious.
Right.
And then he falls like an anvil. So as long as I walk across the sky, run across the sky, step out on that stage, kill the ego, not know who I am at that moment, I'm fine. If I just open the door and let nature speak through me. But if somebody coughs in sort of a strange way or breaks the spell, then I get self-conscious and I start to sink, you know, and then I have to get rid of ego again and just, you know, say it's not me talking. It's coming through rather than from. And that's the feeling I have when you're writing in a trance. A great actor, I think, when the lines are being spoken through you rather than you saying them. Mm-hmm. You know? And those are the moments of transcendence that I really live for, because I love that territory when we sort of lose ourselves into something much bigger.
Yeah. That's a great observation on that cartoon, which also has always been one of my favorites. And I never really thought of it that way. And you're absolutely right. It's that self-awareness that then gets in the way. And that would always be what would hit him, it seemed, in multiple times in the show. So great observation.
And, you know, there he is just trucking right across the sky, you know, because he believed he could. He was so in the chase.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he looked down and, oh, this is me. And why am I, you know, and there he sank. So.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't be doing this. No one can run in the sky. And then, you know,
exactly.
Sets in the doubt. You know, I want to tie into this as well then about consciousness and awareness. So what is your definition of consciousness or conscious living?
Well, you know, the great thing about the island, and this is, I think, what we're losing by turning our backs on nature, is I would wake up in the morning in this tiny little cabin that was 20 by 40 feet. And I slept up high in a loft because that way you catch all the heat from your wood stove as it rises to the ceiling. But whether it's winter, summer, spring, any season, when I would open my eyes, my breathing, the breath of the ocean right outside the front door, kind of lapping onto the beach stones, the wind in the trees, the humpback whales and killer whales exhaling, it was all one breath. So as you're breathing, the world is breathing. And to start your day of conscious reality that way, it was like you were moving through a meditation. You were into the mystical rather than, you know, multitasking in a cell phone and the 10 different things that split our concentration. Our deep connection to life. And I think nature is that great teacher. And I see it so often, even on the cruise ship, when people come back, you know, to their real home and they see a glacier that's 250 feet tall from the water line to the top icy spires. That's a 25 story building and it's dropping pieces of ice that are as big as somebody's house at home. And those ice chunks are sapphire blue. So they hit the water just a couple hundred yards away from a cruise ship that's 3 football fields long. And that splash will come toward us and actually rock the ship. So they see it. They hear it. The sound is called white thunder. The natives call it that. And then they feel it. And when nature is that sensuous, you know, when you can walk in those forests after a rain and just smell that fresh loam, you know, and the oxygen that all those plants and trees are giving out. I mean, to make that connection that on that deep conscious level up there, nature, it just rejuvenates you. It restores you. It heals you.
That sounds beautiful. Making me want to go on a cruise up to Alaska now.
And you know, it can happen in a backyard. Feeding hummingbirds or women that grow orchids or roses. It's just keeping that connection, you know, sticking your hands in the dirt as a gardener, because that really is the world that we came from. In fact, somebody once told me that if you believe in evolution, man's been on Earth about 2 million years. We have lived in cities. If you consider that time frame, we've lived in cities for about the past 10 seconds. And the rest of that time, We were hunter-gatherers. You know, nature was our home. And you don't get rid of that, you know, in 100 years or whatever.
Right.
We still feel that connection when we go back to a place in balance like Alaska.
Yeah, so how do you then practice, you know, staying in a conscious state when, I mean, I get how it could be when you're in nature and it's all surrounding you, but as you mentioned too, now we've got cell phones and everything else that are lulling us into this autopilot and going to sleep. So how do you practice yourself staying awake and conscious in, say, like New York City?
Well, I try to discipline, although some days that goes out the window, as you probably know, when, you know, you're busy and in somewhat demand or whatever, some days worse than others.
Mm-hmm.
But I try to go, okay, social media, I'm going to give it 1 hour of my day, usually in the morning, answer emails, keep up with Twitter, Facebook, things like that, because it is a blessing to be able to connect with people. And especially as an author, to be able to be in touch with your readers, you know, and not be some diva that pretends you're all that, but to actually, you know, respond back and to keep that circle of communication going. Mm-hmm. So I try to discipline it. And like keep it, you know, within a time frame, certain times of the day. But I must tell you that I'm really worried because the millennials, the next generation, a hypnotist, entertainer on the cruise ship once told me, if you want to hypnotize somebody, you flash a light in their eyes. And that's basically what these devices are doing, what a TV show is doing, like MTV. Mm-hmm. It is strobic. The camera never rests now. It is so chopped up. And I must tell you a quick story. A woman came by my book table 2 summers ago on the cruise ship, and she was in tears. And we had just come out of Glacier Bay with the big icebergs calving, and whales were jumping all around the cruise ship. And I go, ma'am, what's wrong? And she said, Michael, we spent thousands of dollars to bring our 2 teenage sons on this cruise, and it's not even the money. But do you think they're out there in that amazing champagne air watching all this amazing magic? No, they're up in the teen center. In a, just like their dark bedroom and home, and they're playing video games day and night up there. We can't get them out of that little place.
Mm.
So about 10 minutes later, a kid walked by. It wasn't her son, but he could have been. You know, he's probably 14, 15 years old. He had wires circling both sides of his torso. He had earbuds, a backup pair of earbuds behind his ears. He had 2 Game Boys, one in each hand. And there were so many bombs going off in the palms of his hands. I mean, you could hear the explosions before he came around the corner. And I flagged him down, and it took him about a minute to unplug. And then he couldn't look at me. It was almost as if having a conversation with a real human being wasn't something that he did very often,
mm-hmm.
or that he felt very comfortable with. And he had a can of Red Bull, I'll never forget, between his pinky finger and his ring finger, somehow wedged in there amidst all the technological devices he was holding. And it probably wasn't his first sugar and caffeine rush of the day, you know. And he was sort of twitching around, and I tried to talk his language, and I said, dude, why up there, pointing up above the theater to where the teen center was? I go, why up there and not out there? Pointing out the window where the whales and glaciers are. And his answer was scary, Michael. He said, nature's too slow. It takes too long for anything to happen. I can kill 22 people right now. And I'll never forget, on the side or the front of his thumbs, he had calluses that were sticking out like horns from hitting those machines, tap, 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 probably a million times a day.
Wow.
And I'm going, okay, is that a teenager going through, you know, the teenage phase and then someday he's going to outgrow it? Or is his generation so attached to devices that it's rearranging the neurons in the brain? And teachers tell me they can't just stand in front of a classroom anymore. They have to have bells and whistles and, you know, be almost like a Broadway show,
mm-hmm.
to keep their minds engaged. And then one grandma came up to me and she said, Mike, I was babysitting my granddaughter. I took her to Barnes & Noble and I was showing her a magazine, a printed magazine. And this little girl had an iPad ever since she was like 3, 4 years old. and they were looking at pictures together in the magazine, and a little girl on the printed paper magazine, she was tapping and trying to swipe a photo. And she said, "Grandma, why doesn't it move?" And the grandma said, "I had to explain to her what a real physical object is."
Wow.
So technology excites me. It connects, you know, it connects us to the world. The speed of, but is it alienating us? Is it rearranging our attention span where we can't think long and deep? It's, I guess, yet to be determined.
Yeah. Man, Michael, we could go into a whole episode just talking about that because so many things struck my mind as you know, you were sharing that story.
How do you feel? When you look at 100 years ahead of man on Earth, are you hopeful? Are we evolving for the best or are we de-evolving? How do you feel?
I don't know. It's a mixed bag. I do believe that there is a waking up that's going on right now, and I'm hoping that it will trend down towards our teens. And, you know, I know I try to raise my son who is in that range right now. He loves to play games all the time. He's even considering a career in it. But, you know, I'm trying, of course, to get him to balance it and see the world and not be stuck in front of a screen all the time. And it's a challenge. You know, it's incredible.
You know, there's a little tiny town in Alaska we stop once a week. It's called Skagway. It's where the Klondike Gold Rush happened 100 years ago with all those miners. Jack London wrote about it, Robert Service poetry. Mm-hmm. It's a magic little place. It's a mountain barrier town. There's only like 900 people that live there, and you just have these, you know, magical mountains coming right out of the ocean all around this town. I went in a little coffee shop, you know, the fresh buns, the baking was filling the whole town with sweetness. And I went in to get an espresso. Mm. And a sign on the coffee shop door in Little Skagway, Alaska, it said, "No, we do not have Wi-Fi. Talk to each other."
I love it.
If somebody was 12 or 13, they'd go, "What?"
Right. Yeah, so it is a challenge, and man, I hope for the best. You know, I'm holding out hope, and I just hope. There's one of the things about it for me is that we're creating this technology, and it's advancing so fast, but I don't think our capability to handle it is keeping up with it, and I think that's the challenge. You know,
yeah,
that we're not evolving.
It's disrupting sleep. In fact, you know, there was this big argument, oh, printed books are going the way of the dinosaur. You know, well, they still, a paper book still sells 67% and the ebooks are the rest of the percentage.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been proven. And this is kind of scary. I mean, I love to have an e-reader when I go on a trip because I can take, you know, 150 books
right.
And, you know, carry a pound and a half around. But when I'm home, of course, I have the paper books because I joke and say I can always tell how good a book's going to read by how it smells.
Mm.
You know, I want that tactile sensation. I want to smell the paper. I want to hear the crinkle of the pages as they turn.
Oh, yeah.
Well, scientists and medical doctors have just determined that if you read yourself to sleep at night, you know, for that half hour before you doze off or whatever to catch up on a book or a magazine, if it's an e-reader – and your face is being bathed in that electronic light, the pineal gland on our forehead between our two eyes, that's often called the third eye in countries like India, that's getting all that light that charges up your brain. It changes your REM sleep waves at night, and it interferes with your melatonin distribution as well. So they're advising turn off the e-reader before you go to bed at night, read the paper book. Because you don't want that blast of light exciting your brain and rearranging your chemistry.
Mm, that makes sense to me. And quite honestly, I don't like to read books electronically. I love still holding a paper volume in my hands or something. Just, it's very tactile for me. I love it.
But you know, I think we're getting to a point. It's here now, but I think it's even going to get more intense and you hearken to it. How do we separate the physical world from the virtual world?
Mm-hmm.
Because they are so blended together. And I think a lot of people are feeling more comfortable. They have more control in the virtual world than they do in the physical world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think too, they feel less exposed in it. You know, I was talking to a fellow podcaster the other day that, you know, one of the great things about podcasting is you could be anybody, anywhere, sitting in a basement somewhere, and you don't have to go out to the world. Now, I like to. I like to reach out and meet people, but you can be just a quiet voice in a room somewhere and never physically meet people. So there's something about that with the electronic thing that I think also is, you know, attracting a certain element in teens.
And, you know, a lot of people that meet online through dating services, mm-hmm. they really, and it is true, that they really got to know each other through an audio Skype, through FaceTime, Skype, FaceTime. You know, there's a lot of communication that's going on. So when they finally physically meet, that's the icing on the cake. Mm-hmm. But they bake the cake through technology at first.
Right.
So, and to me, I say it's a great thing. But it's just like the moon. The moon is luminous, but it also has a dark side, you know?
That's very true. So, Michael, what are you up to right now in your life that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I'm like to think that my, and I kind of get feedback on this, that my writing is very visual. That when people read my books, they say they really are sort of watching them or seeing them. So we're getting very, very close to putting Wildlife, The Misadventures of a Cosmo Bachelor, which is kind of like my whole life story because we have a lot of Alaska in there. In fact, Alaska is going to be one of the main characters. I really want to make it happen as either a movie and even better right now as a TV series because some of the best work as far as narrative storytelling is going on in television mm-hmm. with HBO, Showtime, some of these great series. And, you know, Wildlife would definitely translate into an ongoing series where each episode, you know, he dates one woman from, you know, around the world and from all of these possibilities that he learns so much from in so many ways. And of course has crazy adventures and wild sex and all of that mm-hmm. as well. So, I mean, we could take it out 5 or 6 seasons and then maybe even end up with a feature film. Where he finally makes a choice of, you know, and that is the great thing that we all face is perplexity of choice. How do we find that partner to go through life with?
Yeah.
When there's so many variables that have to match up. And so we're working on that right now and I got a little bit of interest from Warner Brothers. So I'm going to try to, you know, go in that direction and just see where it takes me.
Cool. Best of luck with that.
Oh, thank you.
I'd love to see it. Well, we've reached the end of the show, and I always like to leave the listeners with a juicy pearl of wisdom that our guests can share that they could put to use right now to improve their lives today. So what would that be from you?
I think it would just be the words, we attract what we are. And I really believe that nothing happens to us just randomly or happenstance. I really believe that our thoughts are things and they are electromagnetic and they are very powerful. You know, every once in a while along a coast, be it California or Oregon, you'll see a rock that has like a window hole through it. And the rational mind in a lot of ways would go, well, a rock is going to be much stronger than just liquid water. But I equate that liquid water to human thought. And I mean, human thought can move mountains. It can put that hole right through that sea stack or that rock, mm-hmm. you know, and our minds are magnets and we put out electromagnetic energy with our thoughts and we attract, you know, the thought level that we are at. And I know that negative thought can create disease internally and positive thought. In fact, there was a great humorist and a writer named Norman Cousins who had cancer and actually healed himself through humor and laughter. You know, he just read joke books continuously instead of taking chemotherapy and he laughed himself healthy just by the release of endorphins, even on a physical level when we're in the act of laughter. So I think that we attract what we are, that we direct our movies for the better or for the worse.
Great words of wisdom. I so appreciate that, Michael. And I also, and I also appreciate you taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on Consciously Speaking and share your wisdom with our listeners today.
Michael, I must tell you that, you know, I do a lot of interviews and this is what I live for. The connection that we have just had, it felt like 2 minutes. And when you link up with a kindred spirit such as yourself, the time-space continuum just disappears.
Yeah.
And I just wanted, my soul bows to your soul because I sense that you have done a lot of growth and that you are a very highly evolved being. And it's actually a deep honor to be in your presence. Mm. And I really mean that.
Mm. Thank you so much, Michael. That means a lot to me. I really appreciate that.
Because I live for conversations like this where you go deep and meaningful and have fun as well.
Yeah.
Rather than staying on the surface and the superficial. That is just so boring anymore. I want to go deep. I want to find the meaning. And you're on that same path. It's wonderful.
Absolutely. Well, thanks again. It's greatly appreciated. And I'm sure my listeners are going to love you.
Thank you, brother. Have a great day.
You too.
You've been listening to Consciously Speaking with me, your host, Michael Neely. Tune in Monday through Friday for conversations with today's premier conscious thought leaders, authors, and coaches. On Saturdays, you can find peace of mind through a guided meditation with a variety of guest leaders. And on Sunday, don't miss our topic of the week, where you can join a deep dive into issues that matter the most. Be sure to subscribe so that you don't miss a single episode. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and a review. I'll even give you a shout out on an upcoming episode as my way of saying thanks. You can learn more about the show, check out the guests' bios, leave comments and feedback at www.michaelneely.com. Until next time, live without limits.